Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
This is Serious Privacy. Here are your hosts, Paul Breitbart and Kay Royal.
Almost 2 weeks ago, at the end of March, Kay started a new job, and because of that, she was traveling to her new company's headquarters. Luckily, that same week, I find myself together with our go-to guest co-host, Ralph O'Brien, teaching a new course at Maastricht University, a masterclass on privacy management and data governance. You'll hear more about that program and a very condensed version of what Ralph and I explain during the course in this week's episode. And for those of you interested, a new edition of the course will be coming in October. More links in the show notes. My name is Paul Breitbart.
My name is Ralph O'Brien, and welcome to Serious Privacy.
So Ralph, as they say in good English, bien étonné de se retrouver ensemble. Bit of a surprise that you and I are recording this week, actually. But we find ourselves together at Maastricht University to provide a data protection masterclass on privacy management, accountability, and building a program. And Kay is out in the world to start her new job. So thank you so much for stepping in.
Not at all. Always a pleasure. And may I say, it's been a pleasure actually presenting with you this week. Paul and I, we've known each other for a long, long time now, but I was actually saying to Paul earlier in the week, even though we've sort of done a lot of work together, we've never really worked together.
It's true. And I mean, last year we were together in the same room when you were taking the DPO course while we were in Lisbon. Now we actually get the chance to teach together. And I thought it was really in the past 2 days. There will be for sure another day on Friday where we continue. What I found fascinating is your full ISO background in this whole compliance framework approach that we've been discussing. I mean, basically, the course is about maybe set the stage a little about building a compliant privacy management program from scratch, how to demonstrate compliance, especially with the GDPR. It follows up on our basic PR DPO course and the humanitarian action DPO course. And from there, we continue now with privacy management and expanding your program. And I've never worked with anything ISO related. And I've never done anything ISO related. So for me, it's really interesting to learn that part.
Yeah, I mean, I've really loved this course. And I've really loved this course because, you know, you teach data protection. And so you teach international transfers and legal basis and what's the definition of personal data. And you teach that a million times over. But what's been lovely about this week was talking about business skills, talking about softer skills, talking about building a business case and how to pitch data protection. And yes, I'm a big fan of management systems. Now, you know, I'm probably most known for data protection and privacy, but actually I did a spell as a British Standards Auditor for ISO 27001, and I actually sit on the committee that writes some of the ISO standards, including its data protection cousin 27701. So to kind of tell people about, you know, ISO certification and ISO standards and using a management system inside your business, it's been a real privilege. It's been a real privilege.
So tell us a bit more about ISO, because I've heard you talk about the ISO standards 27001, 27701. I'm still surprised that 27701 uses US terminology with new identification. How does that work? How does an ISO standard work?
Well, it's about consensus. It's about trying to get everybody in the world to agree to something. Now, Paul, if you and I came up with our own standard, of course, that would be quite specific to you and I. But, you know, it would have our names on it, which I'm sure would count for something. But, you know, it doesn't have the same. Yeah, which would count for something. But it doesn't have quite the same level of DOS as, you know, an entire industry sector or an entire country or indeed an entire globe, right? But obviously, the more people that have got to agree on something, the less specific it can be. So when we go up to an ISO, and we've got an international standards committee based in Geneva, but they're based on national committees that sit underneath that and industry committees that sit underneath that. So you've got this like great, what they call consensus, a great level of agreement that this is the right and good thing to do. But these standards have then got to apply to the whole world, you know, any mm-hmm. industry sector, any organization of any size. So they sometimes lack some of the specifics you might find in an industry or local standard.
When you look at, I think everybody knows ISO 27001, which is the key mm-hmm. security standard, data security standard that has mm-hmm. been around in my opinion forever, but probably only for a couple of decades or so. But 27001 is fairly new in data protection.
Mm. Yeah, it's been a really interesting journey. I mean, you can trace standards right back to a British standard called, well, in fact, the first British standard was about rail gauges. It was the fact that, you know, Stevenson built his railway in the south and Johnson in the north. And when the two railroads met each other, they looked down the tracks and went, they were different gauges, different sizes. And so, you know, this idea of standardization and building things to an agreed standard. So when they meet up, they work together, you know, so we see standards for everything, whether it be screwdrivers and screws and rule plugs that all work together. You know, but we're really looking here at management system standards. And the genesis of them came from what we call quality management, which was about manufacturing. And basically, the British realized they'd fallen behind the Japanese in terms of manufacturing. They sent a guy called Mr. Deming over to Japan. And he came back and basically said, you're stuck in the do. And what he meant by that was, you're just delivering without really looking at, you know, if the customers are going to appreciate it, if you're delivering what the customers want. So management systems are really about building in what they call continual improvement, a cycle where the management really get involved right from the planning stage to delivery stage to really getting a lot more measuring and monitoring and improvement. And then you get lots of different management systems. So even though it started in manufacturing, we've seen information security, quality, environment, and now data protection. The only slight addendum with the data protection one is it's kind of been put in as a subset of the security one, which I'm sure a lot of our fellow privacy professionals won't agree with mm-hmm. at all. So you cannot get the data protection badge, if you like, without having the information security badge first or at the same time.
And then, if you have those two, are you GDPR compliant?
Well, you get some varying views on that. I mean, one of the interesting things, and one of the reasons the EU Commission didn't like 27001 or 27701 as a certification standard, was that you could do it for limited scopes. You could certify a product or a service, or, you know, even your broom cupboard. You know, you could select a scope and a boundary for your ISMS or what we now like to call a PIMS, a personal information management system, especially nice as I'm a fan of the drink in the UK. Does it make you GDPR compliant? Well, technically, you are supposed to, as part of your audit, prove to your auditors and assessors that you have know yourself, yeah, that you've looked at all the legal, regulatory, contractual requirements that are placed on you, and you're delivering in accordance with them. Mm-hmm. So technically, yes, if you are, you know, you're being audited and you should have factored in all of those requirements. But does your audit look at every facet and faction of a full GDPR audit? I'd suggest not.
So in the end, the honest answer would probably no, you are not fully compliant. Then let me ask the next question. Can you be fully compliant?
Well, we've had this conversation all week, haven't we? And you know, my view is no. You know, I ask every course I go through, you know, to look at the GDPR and look at it as a principle-based standard. And therefore, there are no yes-no answers. There are no yes or no answers. And, you know, when you look at words like necessary and proportionate and adequate and justified and necessary, you know, this comes down to an organization deciding the level they're going to go to. And actually, if the data subject makes that same determination, their necessity and adequacy and proportionate might be very different from yours as a controller. So true. I always actually start my data protection courses by telling people, you're always going to be wrong. You know, you're always going to be wrong because the data subject's own bias will of adequate and necessary and proportionate will be different from yours, will be different from the regulators, will be different from another controllers. So can we be binary yes, no compliant? I'd suggest no.
No, I am also there. I tend to agree. And I think there, I very much also agree with my former boss, Terry McQuay, who said, well, compliance is a binary state. You either are or you are not. It is much more about demonstrating or the capacity to comply and demonstrating ongoing compliance. Because if you have the theoretical capacity to comply, you can also tell the story behind your privacy program. Mm. There is always the possibility of somebody making an error. We are all humans. We make errors. I haven't met anybody in my life, I think, who has never caused a data breach by sending an email to people in CC where they intended. BCC, that happens.
And
no, I don't believe you when you say that.
No. Not at all. Not at all.
And that is exactly the point. People make mistakes, and there is no problem in making mistakes. Also, DPAs themselves make mistakes. Also, that is not a problem. As long as we are able to understand that we make mistakes and what to do next. And I think that is the important part of building a compliant privacy program. It is not so much about being compliant for the full 100% all of the time. It is about being able to understand what you are doing and what you should be doing and doing that when something goes wrong.
Well, that's actually why I like a management system standard, because it forces a framework on an organization that means that the management have got to invest time in understanding what's going wrong. Yeah, the idea of a continual improvement program is just that. You do audits and measurements and monitoring and products and your services, and you know, invest time in looking at customer feedback and complaints, and you sort of look at all of that and go, you know, what's the root cause of this? How can I take the best corrective actions, if you like, or the best preventive actions to mean that on my next go round the circle, on my next sort of management cycle of plan, do, check at, you know, I'm taking some sweeping improvements that's going to make me evolve and go forwards. And, you know, essentially when we don't evolve, we die, you know, Evolving is good for business, right? And so, you know, there is this horrible word in audit. They use the term non-conformity. You know, personally, I use the word improvement opportunity. It's nicer.
Always try to frame it in the positive.
Yeah, it is much nicer. And that's what's been so nice about this week's Trojan Training with you, because, you know, we've been talking about, you know, it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to make mistakes. And we've been talking about the difference between ethics and the law and risk, you know, and I know that we've had a previous podcast recently looking at ethics but you know, some organizations come in and go, I really want to be ethical, and then you tell them what that involves, and you know, actually helping them to understand their own values and their value tensions, and they kind of go, oh well, what does the law say? And then you tell them that, and they go, oh well, what's the risk? you know, and you kind of go through this process,
and,
right?
And what kind of risk are you then talking about? Is this the risk to the business in case something goes wrong? Is this the risk to the fundamental rights and freedoms of the individual? Or would that be the question, what is the risk to be found out if we are just doing what we're doing?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we've all had organizations. And one of the things that sort of seems to get a lot of attention and get a lot of traction during the course this week is I put up a slide with a load of animals on it and kind of said, you know, what GDPR animal are you? And I know that sounds really silly and really trite, but the management love it because you say, you know, are you an ostrich? Do you bury your head in the sand? Are you an elephant? Do I ever got to eat you a bite at a time? Are you a hamster in a wheel? Are you a fox, a risk manager? Are you a lion? Do you want to roar about privacy to your customers?
I'm a unicorn. What else?
Yeah, a unicorn. That's my humanitarians, right? The people that actually do value fundamental rights and have that as a priority in their business. And they are more few and far between. You know, I see far more turtles that want to like legal up and defensively armor. And they come to me and say, oh, what's the legal red line? What's the minimum I have to do for compliance? And that tells you a lot about an organization when you first go in and speak to them, actually.
But those are also the same people probably that see compliance as a tick box exercise, where you just have a checklist and you go down the checklist and say, okay, I have a notice done. I have a policy for access request done. Data portability, not so relevant. Ignore for now. Right? I mean, data breach protocol. Yeah, we have it in place. We keep a log of all the incidents. Check.
Yeah. And actually, if I had sort of one, if I was going to rename the course we've been delivering this year, it's actually more how to mature your privacy program, right? It's how to move away from that tick box legal compliance that you go into it with, or a lot of organizations go into it with, and mature it to more of a, value add, you know, rather than an external cost and an internal benefit where you're doing more sort of privacy by design activities, where you're getting in earlier, where you're being more proactive rather than reactive with helping the organization to design in privacy rather than check boxes later on and paper over the cracks.
So without giving away the full content of the course during a 1 hour podcast, which is impossible because this is a 5 day full-time course.
Yeah.
But still, what is the main recommendation if people want to take this masterclass?
It's about recognizing that actually, I think sometimes we're our own worst enemy, that we, you know, we've got a bit of a reputation for saying no, and other people will look at us as the people that will come in and stop the business process, the person that will come in. And that's often because we're involved too late. It's often because we get called in too late. We've got this new bit of software, do a DPIA on it. Well, it's too late. You know, the software's there, it's being used. And yeah, we're not going to have the impact that we could do or make the protections we could do. So it's about trying to reposition yourself from that horrible no naysaying legal compliance person to the very positive enabler that's going to get involved earlier in projects and to add value to the business rather than take away from it, I guess.
From blocker to builder, as we heard last year at Privacy Space.
Well, yeah, I wasn't going to use the term because I've been using it so much, really. But I always feel like I need to shout out to Luke and when I do so. But, you know, I've never found a phrase that encapsulates it so well. It's, yeah, from blocker to builder. Really, and it's been such a privilege to work with not only yourself and the rest of the staff at Maastricht this week, but, you know, some of the delegates as well who, you know, they've done their basic DPO. They know the law. And what they're looking for are frameworks and tools and techniques to, you know, build their privacy program from you know, and take it to that next level.
Yeah, and it is not just building a program from scratch or redesigning a program that's already existing, but also doing so while keeping the business open. Because if you read the GDPR, everything that you need to do, you need to do in the perfect world before you start processing personal data. You need to do your processing operations. You need to identify your legal basis. You need to draft your notice. You need to do your impact assessment and your data protection impact assessment, mitigate your risk, do a prior consultation with the DPA if need be. And all of that needs to be done before you start processing personal data. And that's a bit of a fiction when you are living in a world where companies have been processing data for many decades.
Yeah, you can't stop the world from turning. And, you know, as a consultant, I think I can count the amount of projects on one hand where it's been a greenfield, where it's been, you know, hey, we're designing something, come in and help us because we're new. And from day one, we can build this in. You know, 99% of the projects I've ever been involved in are, you know, the world is already turning, you know, and, you know, we're talking about data inventories. By the time you start your data inventory, well, it's changed by the time you've come to the end of the project. You know, it's already out of date, you know, but by the time you've got that first snapshot. But yeah, the world keeps turning, you know, business keeps evolving and growing. And, you know, and catching up is hard, especially when there's actually, you know, you mentioned all these things you've got to do proactively. But then there's equally the reactive side. There's new products, new services, rights requests, new laws, new standards, you know, new product service lines, new acquisitions, new mergers. You know, the world doesn't stop turning underneath your feet. So as well as the proactive side of managing data protection, they've got the reactive side as well to have to deal with. It's not easy.
No, it's certainly not. So if anybody wants to follow this course, if you are interested, it is on campus only. We'll likely be back sometime in October, probably in Maastricht, which Ralph can now testify is one of the nicer cities on the continent.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, the food, and Paul's a great tour guide as well. Paul walked me around Maastricht, or, well, a limited small proportion of it, and took me through the history and the food. It was lovely.
So yeah, keep an eye on the website of the European Centre on Privacy and Cybersecurity. That's the end of the promo talk. Of course, we also just love discussing building that privacy program. But Ralph, now that I have you, I just see a report coming in out of the UK that your High Court has once again ruled that the Data Protection Act 2018 is in part unlawful. Surprise,
yes.
Surprise.
Yes, indeed. Good development. Yes. And This is actually a second judicial review because when
of the same data, law.
Of the same in part of the same law. So in the back of our Data Protection Act 2018, we've got a number of schedules that contain a load of exemptions. And one of those exemptions that they put in was for immigration. Surprise, surprise, the UK treats people coming into its borders slightly differently than its residents and citizens. Now, there's a lot of politics here. I personally think, why take away rights from the people who need them the most? And that's pretty much what the High Court judgment said. I mean, it was challenged by a number of human rights groups. And we actually, back in July 21, we had our first judgment that said, you know, that immigration exemption in the Data Protection Act to deny immigrants their data protection rights is illegal. And then what we had is a bit of secondary legislation passed. And it basically said, well, the government basically said, well, okay, so what we'll do is rather than make it a blanket exemption, we will have the Home Secretary be able to sort of sign off an exemption for immigration in limited cases. And it was a piece of secondary legislation that we passed. The problem is that's been used quite extensively. And so this second piece of judicial review is to kind of say, have the government done enough? Is that change in law enough to give people their rights and freedoms and to get balance right between the needs of the state and the needs of the individual refugee or immigrant? And this court case today says no. And it gives the UK government another 3 months, essentially, to come up with another plan or scrap the immigration exemption altogether.
Interesting. The other piece of news that is just in is that Iowa indeed has become the sixth U.S. state to enact comprehensive privacy legislation. So hooray for Iowa. I'm sure that Kay and I will talk about it in a lot of detail sometime in the coming weeks. But already this law will go into effect on the 1st of January 2025, which means that you have about 21 months to get ready for Iowa and see whether you meet the requirements. It's fairly similar to what we see in California. So it applies to people who are residents of the state of Iowa. So all of us Europeans, why would we bother? But still, it might be if we do business in Iowa that we are also subject to the Iowa legislation. If at least the personal data of 100,000 Iowa consumers, that's about 3% of the state's population, is processed, or if more than 50% of your gross revenue comes from people in Iowa, which means at least 25,000 consumers, or if you make more than $25 million US dollars. In all those situations, the legislation will apply. I haven't seen the swanky abbreviation for this one yet, but I'm sure we'll come up with something nice.
Yes. I was just looking at this myself, and I must admit I haven't, had the chance to look at it in depth, and I'm sure Kay will be a much better person to talk about it than I will be. But the, what I find fascinating is this sort of state-by-state approach where every state has got slightly different definition of personal data, slightly different applicability at what level of business it should apply to, slightly different, penalties, slightly different rights. And, in a way, we sort of take our GDPR for granted, but I do feel for the, and I know each of our member states have got their own laws and exemptions on top of that, but I do feel at the moment for, privacy professionals in the US, we're trying to track, not only the 4 or 5 state laws we had last year, but the 10, 12 we've got on the decks to come in this year. Is if all of those are just going to be slightly different, I think our US colleagues are certainly going to have to start tracking from one to the other. It's going to make their lives a lot more complex.
Yeah, and I guess we can also start develop a compliant privacy program course for our US customers, explaining how to deal with 50 different state laws for consumer privacy on top of all the other 400 and something data protection laws that the US have.
It's the biggest problem that any company is to deal with at the moment, isn't it? It's just, global business, local law.
Yeah. So I'm curious to see what the activities of the Council of Europe and the OECD will bring in the coming years, probably, to develop some international standards. On the one hand, on government surveillance and government access. When it comes to the OECD, the project run by Japan, there will be a panel on that at IPP Washington next week, which I'm looking forward to listening to. And on the other the Council of Europe that keeps promoting Convention 108 as the only possible binding legal standard at global level for data protection.
I'm so jealous that I won't be in DC with you and Kay. You know, I'd love to say that I'm ditching it for fee paying work, but actually I will be in the US, but doing something a lot more geeky in Florida. So a bit of a holiday actually for a change.
I'm not completely sure whether Kay might not actually be jealous of you.
I've been to APP DC a couple of times, and regardless of the content and the size of it and the scale of it, you know, always good to meet your fellow professionals and meet up in a friendly environment and catch up. And that's what's been so good about this week, actually spending a bit more time face to face with you, Paul. So I'm sure it's Kay's turn next week.
She absolutely has her turn next week. So Ralph, thank you so much for joining in at the last minute. We'll keep it a bit of a shorter episode this week, but I'm pretty scared of the length of the episode or episodes that we'll record at IAPP already. So for our listeners, this will be a short one, but expect some longer ones in the coming weeks when Kay and I are back from Washington. Thank you all for listening to yet another episode of Serious Privacy. Like and review the episodes in your favorite podcast app or your favorite podcast platform. Join the conversation on LinkedIn, where you'll find us under Serious Privacy. You'll find Kay on the social media as Heart of Privacy, myself as EuroPolB, and Ralph at IGR O'Brien, if I recall correctly.
You do indeed.
Until next week, live from DC, bye.
Bye, y'all.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.